is Carl Gerald Nygaard, and I served in the United States Air Force from 11 September 1956 to the 1st of October 1978. I served in Vietnam as the war that I participated in.
And Jerry, where were you born?
I was born, if you want precisely, or just the sit town.
Whatever you want to tell us.
All right. Well, I was born in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, at the home of a Mrs. Gridley who was provided her house in those days because doctors still made house calls, and Dr. Rutledge was in attendance, and my grandmother acted as the midwife.
Interesting.
Kind of the way it came about.
But Detroit Lakes. Okay. And who were your parents?
My father is Carl E. Nygaard. His name is spelled with a K. Mine starts with a C. And my mother was Helen Elizabeth Nygaard. That were them. And I have one brother, Gordon, and one sister, Bonita. My brother Gordy is 11 years younger than I am. My sister 13 years younger. So for a number of years, I was like an only child. But
now, what did your parents do?
Well, my father, during, starting from about 1945, tested dairy cattle. And by testing, it was the milk, the butter fat in the milk that he tested and kept records of. And my mother was pretty much a housewife that did work odd jobs in one capacity or another, but mostly she maintained the home, and that was pretty much her lot in life.
And where did you go to school?
Well, for the first 6 years, it was unorganized schools in the White Earth Indian Reservation, and then when I started the seventh grade, I started attending school in Detroit Lakes, where I continued for the 6 years, graduating from there in June of 1956.
And what did you do after high school?
Well, after high school, at those times, there was a draft, and they had a lottery, and my number was quite low. So they informed me that I would be subject to be drafted that fall in the Army. So, looking at my options, decided that I would go join the Navy and see the world. So Detroit Lakes was some 25 miles distance, and me and my father was out testing cattle. No transportation was available, so getting into town required hitching a ride, which I managed to do. And when I arrived at the recruiting station, the Navy recruiter, which my target, had gone off someplace. And there I was, wondering what to do next, and this gentleman in there said, can I help you? And I said, well, I was looking for the Navy recruiter. He said, oh, he's out of town today. If you'd like, come over here and I'll tell you about the Air Force. And I did, and that's what happened. He told me about the Air Force, and that was my route in life. I went that direction.
And where did you go for basic training?
Lackland Air Force Base, San Antonio, Texas.
Did you like it down there?
Well, in the dim recesses of my mind, it seemed like there was a lot of people shouting at me in a continuous... So liking it, I suppose, under different circumstances, it would be quite a nice place to visit.
I was thinking more weather-wise.
Oh.
Liking it. Yeah.
Well, it was September, and it was hot. I mean, you're from this area here, and all of a sudden, you're into something that is extremely hot, and they're expected to function at a high rate of speed, so you sweat profusely.
How long was basic training?
They had started a unique program, so I was only at Lackland Air Force Base for 4 weeks.
Oh.
And this wasn't the end of my basic training. Then I was loaded on a troop train and taken to Scottsfield, Illinois, and started into electronics training, at that time airborne communications. The concept was that I would go to school for these 6 hours, and then I would continue my basic training for the other 2 hours. And eventually, although I started in September, did not complete my basic training until the following March. But then by this time, I was close to completing my training in airborne electronics. So By May, I had graduated school and was on my way to Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas.
What was that like?
Well, the Carswell Air Force Base had, at that time, a B-36 is assigned. This was the Strategic Air Command. B-36 is the largest aircraft ever constructed as a bomber. They had 6 pusher-type engines and 4 jets. I remember the tail itself was 5 stories high because I used to have to climb up there.
That was huge.
It was a huge airplane. It was so big that only a few places were strong enough in their runway construction that the plane could actually land and take off. And of course, it was a huge plane, and it was the initial deterrent for the Russian Bear at the time. And they were capable of carrying enough. See, there was no refueling at this time. This plane had to carry its own fuel, and it could launch and take off and stay airborne for 24 hours. It had facilities for 2 different flight crews on board. In the back of the plane, there were sleeping quarters for 1 crew while 1 was up front flying. And there was a little chute that went through the bomb bay compartment so the crew, 1 at a time, could change places and then continue flying the airplane in shifts until they had completed their mission.
Amazing.
Yeah.
How long were you in the base in Fort Worth?
Well, I arrived there in May of 1957, and I departed there in 1958 in December and went to Newfoundland, Ernest Harmon Air Force Base. Arriving there in January would be like the 3rd of 1959. And I served there from then, 1959, through 59 and through 1960 until September. September 1960, I was reassigned to Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. At this time, Minot Air Force Base was just being constructed. In fact, the farmer that owned the land the base was being built on still had crop rights. I remember helping him with his hay crop there in that fall after arriving there. And then I served there with the B-52s. Now, back at Ernest Harmon Air Force Base, they had the first tankers that they had in the fleet. They were referred to as KC-97s, and they were prop-type aircraft. And the KC-135, which is the version of the Boeing 707, had been brought into the inventory, and these were the upgraded jet refueling tankers. The B-52s had been constructed and were being implemented in the fleet. When I left Carswell, the first models of the B-52 arrived, but I had nothing to do with them other than to look at them. And the B-36s were so huge that this B-52 seemed small by comparison. But it proved to be back to a large aircraft when I got back to it in Minot Air Force Base. Minot Air Force Base had just nothing except a grouping of tankers, but then after I arrived, they began to bring in the B-52H, which was the latest, greatest version of the B-52 that they had built up to that time, and it could carry missiles on the wings besides. And there I spent 5.5 years at Minot Air Force Base. And you want me to just go on, or?
Where did you go from Minot? After
well,
5 years.
5 years at Minot Air Force Base, I was highly prized because I got suspicious. Most people rotated after about 3 years, and I was there after 4 and pushing 5. And so inquired about why I hadn't been transferred, and they said, well, orders had come down, but your commander had just discarded them because he wanted to keep you on board. So I had an option of, after so many years on an installation, I had an option of applying for a transfer, so I did so. I applied for California, and they agreed to transfer me and and the family I had acquired in the intervening years. And I was reassigned to Mather Air Force Base, Sacramento, California. And at Mather Air Force Base in California, they had basically more of the same, but it was a navigator training wing, so most of the aircraft were dedicated to the educational program training navigators. So when I got there to Mather Air Force Base in California, the B-52s that were present there were actually, well, let me explain. Let's see, I try to keep it in mind. President Lyndon Baines Johnson had come into this Vietnam conflict, and he had opted that we would bomb them to a submission with the B-52s. So when I came to Mather Air Force Base, they were taking part in this. This was going to be the big mission that we were going to entail. So shortly after I got there, I discovered myself at Anderson Air Force Base, Guam, working 12-hour days, 7 days a week, as we attempted to do just that, launch these B-52s heavily loaded with ordnance and fly over Hanoi and Vietnam and then pellet them, or into South Vietnam. We destroyed a lot of jungle, and really. But I did that there after, shortly after my arrival.
What year was this?
This would have been 1965. I departed Minot in September of 65, and with a delay in that, and my family was en route because I heard I could be going to temporary duty when I arrived. And so, at Anderson Air Force Base, Guam, in this particular time, I was entertained by the Bob Hope Christmas troop that come out with the USO. And I saw, at that time, would be Joey Hetherington was married to some football player, Lance Retzel. Yeah, there we go. And Phyllis Diller even was on board. Jerry Colonna, all that group, you know. So I had a first-hand view of them. Of course, ironically, I seen the show again the following year in Vietnam. Because after I was in Guam under this initial bombing efforts we made, I was selected as the one person who had contributed what they said at the time was the most to the success of the mission, and I was rewarded with special recognition. But the big thing is I was allowed to go home early. And so we flew the Pacific and came back to Sacramento so I could get my stuff in order and move my family out there, you see. And of course, that was a nice thing about it. But I got back and got established, and it was really nice because all the planes were over in Anderson Air Force Base One. So I had about 3 weeks after my return to just kind of take it easy. But then they returned, and I suppose even though I'd been awarded a special recognition for all the effort I'd done, I hadn't done enough, because then they told me I would be going to Vietnam, but this time in country, I suppose, to see if I could get the job done over there. I took it kind of personal, you know. I mean, I know there was a whole fleet involved, but anyway, I bring that up, the special recognition, because not to boast, but it just is a little streak of humor.
What an honor.
Because in Vietnam at the time, the Viet Cong had a bounty on us, and the tech sergeant, which I would had made at the time, was worth $38. But if they might have got wind of this special award I had on that B-52 thing, it might have been a lot higher, you know. So I anyway, by November the 7th of 1966, I was in Vietnam, in country. And
what was that like?
Well, it was an adjustment. It was quite a change. You see, to begin with, the jungle affects you kind of like Montezuma's revenge when you go to Mexico. But I don't want to expound on that. I mean, just like it's an adjustment. The bacteria or whatever that's prevalent, your system is not geared for. So you go through a period of adjustment. It takes about 6 weeks or so. And all this time, you kind of keep an eye out for the nearest men's room, because the time you have between the first warning and getting there is condensed to a few steps. But that's when you asked how it was. I adjusted, I suppose, by Christmas. I got there.
You're the first Vietnam vet to tell me that, so I'm glad you said that, because no other Vietnam vet has told me that there is this adjustment because of the jungle.
Well, I can assure you they all went through it,
because
I stood in line while the rest of them were in the hall. Anyway, it's just telling it like it is. And then after I got there, like the 7th of November, see, then once again we were gathered in the field as Bob Hope came again to entertain us at Tan Sanut Air Base, Republic of Vietnam, as they call the time. And I remember distinctly at that time that truce had been declared for Christmas, and the sounds of battle were always around you, the guns and the bombing and the mini ships, and you got used to it. It was like the noise was part of your ambiance. And then they declared a truce, and there was silence. And it's adjustment to silence. But then when the show came in and the troops came to the show from the jungle and on the open, they were gathered. And of course, raining is relatively common. It's just kind of a routine thing, the monsoon bring the rain. And as they were sitting there, and they had kind of a conical thing supporting the stage, just keep the water off the entertainers. Anita Bryant had serenaded us with Silent Night.
Oh.
Beautiful rendition.
Yeah. What was it like having to be there for Christmas?
Well, you had company. You looked around and you weren't alone. Yeah. And you could commiserate.
You know. And you had the entertainers.
I could tell you some really good stories, but see, we'd go on and on and on, so will suffice to say it was different.
Now, while you were in Vietnam, did you have a one-year tour of Vietnam?
Vietnam, when I got there, it was during the big buildup. It was prior to the Tet Offensive, the big Tet Offensive of 1968. And I got there and I served 367 consecutive days, with one exception. I got off out of the country, but I'll tell you about that if you
mm-hmm.
want to.
Yeah.
But I got there, and at that time they hadn't considered the effect of combat on the troop.
Mm-hmm.
So they dealt with the thing called R&R, rest and
relaxation
and recuperation.
Mm-hmm.
And after 6 months in country, the troops were allowed to go out of country for 2 weeks to just regrap. Anyway, they could go like to Hawaii or Australia. I mean, it was really, but when it came to where this was instituted, and I excitedly ran down and said, I'll be up, me, they said, you can't, you've been in country too long, you're not qualified. I had like a simple matter of 2 or 3 weeks I couldn't go, so I had to serve the entire time that whole stint in combat, you see.
367.
367 days. I still remember, you see.
Oh, who could forget?
But I had one time I was given a nice little outing. There is an island in the South China Sea called Konson. And Konson is a unique island. It comprises two peaks that are dormant volcanoes. And where they come together is a little flat area there. And the Coast Guard had a radar site there. And it was kind of a recreational area where the beautiful waters of the South China Sea would provide some, oh, I don't really know who went there, but they offered me an opportunity to go there if I would install a radio system for the aircraft so they could find it in bad weather because it was such a small place. And I agreed to go, so one day I boarded this ancient C-47 type aircraft. Two props, you know, pretty much a little larger than a Piper Cub. But anyway, we flew off and landed there. Beautiful, beautiful island. And discovered it was a political prison. And it was kind of an eye-opener to see how they incarcerated their prisoners. They're not as nice as we are here. They dig a pit and put concrete walls around and put the bars on top, so the weather and everything is like there they are, and the rain, you know, falls on them. And they drop down a bucket that has their food in it and bring up one that has whatever else is in there. And I noticed a campground of people living and said, "What is this?" Well, you see here, when someone is incarcerated, the authorities don't feed them. If they don't have family here to cook for them, they don't survive. See, we've got quite a nice penal system in this country. Of course, you know, you're going back now to 1966 at this time. You see, but the radar site was on top of the mountain, so I had to climb. And they told me they would have prisoners bring my equipment up on that pole where they throw it over their shoulders and climb. So I started ahead to get started on the job, and I climbed the mountain trail. It was kind of like the movies are. The jungle noises follow you to the top. And when I got there, I was exhausted, and I had some refreshments. I won't say what they were. They had a certain alcoholic content, but...
Good for you.
I had refreshed. I'd expired a lot of it. But when I was sitting and I looked around, I noticed a tremendous amount of shotguns on the wall, and I said, "What is the purpose of all these shotguns?" "Souls for the snakes." I said, "There's snakes here." "Yeah, there's 12 species on this island, and 11 of them are poisonous." I said, "Oh, this is not good." But curiosity, I had to ask, what is the one that's not poisonous? Oh, so that's the boa constrictor, you see, so that's the right one. But anyway, I successfully installed the radio, and it worked, and I managed to get down through the jungle path before darkness set in. And I got a chance to swim in the South China Sea, and the plane returned. In fact, I had a tour of the island, and they really did me up proper. And it was just that one day, and then I was flown back to the war, and that was my R&R. So then after November the 9th, of course, I have to keep this 367 worked out. I rotated back to the States, and my family, which at that time comprised of a wife and three kids, were in Kansas, where her family lived. And I went back, and we went on to Michigan, where I was assigned to an Air National Guard base. And it was kind of a nice assignment up in Alpena, Michigan, right along Lake Huron, Thunder Bay, and of course a little reward for whatever, except leaving the jungle and going to Michigan in November is quite an adjustment again, you know. But we settled in there, and the duty was extremely nice because we just had fighter aircraft on alert and maintained them and worked part-time, matter of fact, to take up the time.
So your time, your 367 days in Vietnam, were you right in the war zone? I mean,
there was no battle lines, you know. I mean, the enemy was all around you. You want to know what that was like, okay?
Yeah.
Well, here is how it worked. I had gone in to get a haircut, and the barber that I had frequented there was not there. There was strangers. And inquiring what happened, well, there had been a suicide attack on the installation. And my barber had been annihilated in that. But, see, he was one of the enemy. And he'd been shaving my face for some time before that.
And you didn't know?
Had no idea. Till this event occurred.
Oh, my God.
And that's how it was. When you're there, and well, we got there. I know you're interested in Vietnam. Okay, when we got there, it was a big buildup. Okay, and I'm going to tell you this. I wouldn't believe it if someone told this to me. But I went to the war. Okay, and I got there and. They said to me, we have no place to put you. Okay? We're just built up. We just don't have room here. And so we'll give you this money and you'll have to go downtown and find a place to stay. So I had to go rent a place to live so I could fight the war.
That doesn't even make sense.
Well,
you're the first one to tell me this.
Well,
I never heard another soldier say, I had to go rent a place to
sleep, yeah. Yeah, I had to go rent my... Anyway, I found a place with another fellow named Russell Thurman from Georgia. And we just were thrown together because we arrived at the same time and we got the same, you know, okay, guys, you got to go. So they gave us money at that time. It was the piastres, which is a local currency. And we had scrip. We had no greenbacks. Not allowed. But they give you a scrip, which is a substitute kind of money. And the two of us went downtown, first time ever, and we kind of asked around, and we found an apartment on what they call Truman Key. And, well, the city was, you know, French architecture and whatever, and there were, like, Cholon was the Chinese sector, and we, Truman Key was close to the installation. So we got up in the morning, and we had to hike in and go, you know, do whatever we needed to conduct a war, and then come night we came back home again whenever they let us go on this. But eventually they managed to construct enough facilities, so after about 6 months of commuting from downtown to the war, I was able to get lodgings on the installation to limit, you know, the travel time, because they had a curfew at night, so you were always subject to them. We would be there on the installation, and they put up these barracks, you'd call them, and they put up a big pile of sand, and they told the troops to fill the sand and put the sandbags around the billets in case of an attack. But you worked a 12-hour day in the hot heat. You don't feel like shoveling sand at night, so the whole thing was kind of ignored, those billets were just sitting there. But the object was to put the sandbags up so if a rocket hit this one, the shrapnel wouldn't sweep across. See, it was protection, but there hadn't been attacked in quite a while, and so we got pretty complacent. But then Charlie came with the rockets and mortars one night, and boy, oh boy, the next day, miraculously, all that sand disappeared into bags and appeared, you know, around the... You just need the right motivation, you know, to really kick you in the gear.
And when you say Charlie, you're talking about the North Vietnamese.
Viet Cong. That was just what you called them. It still hangs in my mind, yeah. The Viet Cong was VC, you know, referred to as Charlie.
No doubt you had seen Forrest Gump.
Oh, yes, yes.
What did you think about the depiction of Vietnam in that movie?
That was good. Vietnam was good. I enjoyed that. It really kind of, it had a humorous and very entertaining, of course. And Platoon was another one that they showed the war. Platoon got right down to the nitty gritty, and I think was a pretty good enactment. Yeah, you know, it's easier now to recall, but, you know, and I don't know, you don't want to hear the gory details of what war is like, do you?
I've heard a lot with the World War II deaths.
Yeah, it's not...
Tell me anything.
It's...
Whatever you're willing to share.
General Sherman, you know, that general in the Civil War said it's good that war is such a terrible hell, lest people become too fond of it, you know, but when you talk of it, when the movies show a body coming off a landmine, see, they show it going off intact, but it doesn't go that way.
It's not reality.
The pieces, the body is flimsy, and you have to pick up what you can find in the bag and then bring it and dump it on a table and then try to determine which arm belongs to that torso and how much of it's left. And this took place there, and you witness it going on.
What's it like the first time you see that happen?
It's like a nightmare, it's there and you recognize it, but your mind does not really take it as real. And you see it, and oh my goodness, that's human parts. And these guys are working as best they can to mortuary technicians. And they're putting these together, but the thing I guess I found the most shocking is when you had to go buy this to go to the dispensary, and you know, you required shots and the other things because of the jungle environment. There was gamma globulin and everything. They sent yellow fever, whatever they had. And you'd go there, and these tables were out, you know, in the hot sun, but you'd come there, and during coffee break, these guys and these blood-smattered smocks would be sitting amongst this carnage, having coffee and donuts and talking about what they did the night before. Come so callous to this carnage, you see, that it meant nothing. You know? That's what it comes to in that. That's why these veterans are weird. They're strange. They go for the drugs to allay the reality there, and they're not the same.
After your tour of duty in Vietnam, once you left Vietnam, did you go through a debriefing period?
No.
Any kind of psychological counseling to get through that?
I was fortunate. See, if I would have been 18 years old when this happened, I don't know how I'd have managed. But in 1966, I was 28 years old. I'm old for the time. And I wasn't as subject to the trauma that would have hit me 8 years earlier. So I was more equipped to cope with it, which is I have all the sympathy I can for them that were out of high school and taken to that as their first encounter with life.
I mean,
that's what takes them. That's what brings in the drugs, anything, the drinking, something to drown out what is going on.
Take away the pain.
Yeah.
So you didn't have any type of debriefing. You went basically from Vietnam to Michigan.
Yeah. Just boom, back stateside, and then...
What was that like? I mean, not having a transitional debriefing period, what was that like, going from jungles of Vietnam to, with your family, back to your family again in Michigan? That had to have been just as you said, the weather was one thing, but just psychologically, what was that like?
Well, I was there for 367 consecutive days. I don't want to harp on that. what you see.
Well, I mean, it's gruesome. Yeah.
I've been there a long time.
Yeah.
And as, at first, you know, you just, you're fatalistic. You kind of think, well, I'm not going to make it. Mm-hmm. But 6 months go by, and you start to think, you know, I got halfway. Then you got, okay, you're 100 days. Now, you got 90 dying days left in country. You're a two-digit midget. See, they call them that because you got 90 dying days left, two digits, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as the days start progressing, you're starting thinking, oh, Lord, we're getting close, you know. I mean, I've suffered through this. I want to go home. I want to go home. And the closer it gets and the closer it gets, you can feel the tension mounting. So within a week of rotation, you see, you can't sleep no more. I mean, because you might make it, but they might get you, see. And then you don't want to spend all that time and then finish. This is not good. So when you're there with your crew and the plane, Trans World Airlines, they flew us back nicely. Beautiful stewardesses and everything, and all the drinking and you wanted. It was quite a trip back. Once you got airborne, you know, see. But finally, you get on board the plane, and you are one tense unit. Mm-hmm. But they take off, and you make it. You come home. Mm-hmm. You're exhilarated. You're relieved, right. See. So now nothing bothers you because I survived. I'm home, mm-hmm. And you come there. And you roll in a state of euphoria to be away from there. So the adjustment is kind of delayed, see. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're glad to be home. You're glad to be with your family. There's some residuals because, you see, you'd be walking down the street with your wife and kids, and a car backfires, and you've disappeared. They're looking around. What happened?
Yeah.
And you've taken cover because you've been so geared to that reaction that even though, you know, your mind tells you, but you don't have the time. You know, you're still geared to react. And then you're kind of sheepish as you come out from behind that postal receptacle, you know. And that's just, and it goes away. When I got to Alpena, Michigan, Phelps Collins, the airport was Phelps Collins International Airport, but there was like an air guard unit there, and I was just, you know, with an active unit looking after the couple of fighter planes they had on. I had encountered some tropical afflictions just because of the high humidity and everything. And we had there in the town of Alpena a physician who was a civilian physician, but he was contracted by the military to look after the military personnel that were assigned there. And I had encountered a fungus, ear fungus, that had developed one of the things I'd encountered. And so when I was back in Michigan during the spring, the warm weather came and it returned. And so I made an appointment and went to see the doctor, the contract doctor, who also acted as a local coroner, but that's beside the point. And I went in there and complained about my ear, and he took his thing and he looked in there, and his exact words were, "What the hell is that?" And I said, "Well," he said, "I've never seen nothing like that." He said, "That's horrible." I said, "Yeah, well," he said, "This is a reoccurrence." I said, "Yeah." He said, "What'd they give you?" I said, "Cortisporin." He said, "He wrote a prescription for that." He said, "Try this." He said, "I've never seen it. I don't know. I have no idea what to do." He said, "But try this." He said, "If that's what they gave you, it might work." Well, it did. I had to use it for a period of time and banished it again, which it didn't return, thankfully. But I don't know. How did I get on this drifting line?
It's okay.
I think I was trying to explain what you wanted to know, how the adjustment goes, you know.
Yeah.
So it takes time, but, you know, you come back into reality and it's okay.
Now, you came back to a wife and three children, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, you had your own family thrilled to have you home.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it like as a Vietnam vet coming back into the community? Because this was a very unpopular war. How were you received by other people, knowing that you came back from Vietnam?
Oh, you had to keep your mouth shut because it wasn't popular. No, I mean, you were baby killers and whatever, see, you took it. There was no glory.
No.
No heroes
welcome.
No, that's right. You suffered and you died, but that was it. You know, you didn't. I didn't. I survived. So, mm-hmm. You know, for that I was grateful, but I have a deep understanding of what goes on. I mean, the emotional impact. You were sent there by your elected officials to fight an unpopular war, and you were cursed for doing it, but still, you had no other choice. And even now, you see, there's a popularity again. The military, they're only appreciated in time of need. Mm-hmm. And I suppose those Vietnamese weren't threatening our country, so...
Yeah. What did you do after you left the military? Now, you made the military a career.
Yeah.
Did you know, going into...
Oh, no, you don't want to hear about the times I went back to Southeast Asia, even then, huh?
Oh, I do. Let's get to that. Just one second. I'll let me finish this. When you went into the recruiter's office in Detroit Lakes all those years ago as a young high school graduate, and you wanted to go into the Navy, and you met with this Air Force recruiter, did you know right then and there that you wanted to make it a 20-year career, a lifetime career? Or were you just thinking, it's 4 years of my life, I'll do 4 years, see what happens?
Well, going back to my youth, I was raised on the White Earth Reservation, and the land there is extremely poor, so life was harsh to begin with. And when I went in to the Air Force at that time, it was because I would be drafted into the Army, so let's go and get something out of it. And I went in with no intention of making a career of it. But, you know, they you get used to it, you know, you get there, and at the time I considered, after the first hitch, my options. I had a job at that time, and if I would have gotten out, I would have had to find something, and it was like, well, this isn't too bad. You know, why not? And what I did is I decided, well, I'd give it another go, and then see how things looked. Well, I gave it another go, and this got to be 1960s now, and well... I mean, the older you get, the longer you're in. It's kind of like, well, no point getting out now. I've only got a dozen years, and I can get a retirement check. And that check is nice every month, you know. I mean, my gosh, it's paid for the house.
Good for you.
Yeah, you don't have to drink the cheap beer, you know.
Okay, now, Jerry, you were saying you went back to Southeast Asia again.
Yeah.
After your tour, your 367... days of duty in Vietnam, were you called back there, or did you elect to go back there?
I was sent back there. See, I was I'm really good at what I do. Okay, for performance of duty, I have received 4 commendation, Air Force commendation medals, and the Meritorious Service Award.
Congratulations.
Plus numerous other. See, it's all for the guy that can do the magic. See, the magic.
That's awesome.
Well, to put this mildly, see, well, geez, you know, a lot of this stuff is top secret, you know, but so many years have passed. I don't, you know, you're not supposed to talk about it, but I suppose, I mean, I don't know, there must be a statute of limitations, but okay, we're always planning to fight a war. Mm-hmm. All right, so we test systems, mm-hmm. and the best place to test them is in combat because that's the real thing. Mm-hmm. So we devise weapons platforms, and of course, as the war was winding down and pretty much going to be resolved, we had this set up with airborne forward fighter control, where we had these slow flying planes and then direct fighter attacks and this whole bit. So I served in Korat, Thailand for about 3 months field testing weapon systems and relaying the information back to the engineers who were working and devising these products. You know, yeah, there's a lot of stuff evolved. That was my second stint. But, and, you know...
3 months in Thailand?
Yeah, you know, 3 months in Thailand.
And how long after you came back from Vietnam did you go to Thailand?
Well, I was in Michigan for 3 years in Michigan, and then I opted for California, and I was reassigned to McClellan Air Force Base, which is back in Sacramento. And in McClellan Air Force Base, when I was assigned there, they were also dealing with this temporary assignment to Thailand. Can I take... Okay, here we go. Well, Phelps Collins, Michigan. We'll go back to that point. The outfit I was assigned to at Phelps Collins Air Force, Michigan, was an Air National Guard unit, but it was a detachment from the Wordsmith Air Force Base at Oscoda, Michigan, which was somewhat to the south. But the reason I left there was they decided to close down that particular air defense operation, and I was sent out to McClellan Air Force Base, California. And while I was at McClellan Air Force Base, California, I was sent to Korat, Thailand, to assist in this weapons testing, the wind down the war. This would have been 19 and see, would have been, I got there 68, 69, 70. This is 71 now. This is the winter of 70, 71. And I'm at the Korat Air Force Base, Thailand, Korat, Thailand. Had a unique experience there, you see. There's a lot of things, but we had it's jungle, and of course you drink a lot of liquids. It's regular liquid, but
water.
Yeah, water. Don't drink the water. You know how that goes. But there was a vendor that used to sell Coke and these products, and as you'd be working out on the hot flight line. Now, flight line is the concrete taxiway where the aircraft are parked, and this is where we did the maintenance, to say. And there, a little bit off, and through the grass was this vendor, and used to run over there and get a soft drink to quench that burning thirst. And as I was working one day, a bunch of natives were cutting the long grass. It seemed kind of surprising because it had been there, the time I'd been there, so I inquired what they were cutting it for. I said, well, there's one of them big king cobras had been discovered in that long grass where I'd been running through each day, and they were going to cut it back. Hopefully he would go someplace else. She said, that's kind of
scary.
Recalling. I've been walking through that grass. Oh, no. But anyway, after a time there, I returned to... But what I had done, see, I had been working in the Air Force electronics communications and the whole bit. But I was getting closer to retirement, so I inquired about the possibility of cross-training from my Air Force special into something that would be applicable to my civilian career after retirement. So I applied for television engineering, and they agreed to it. I had served my long and hard and well. So I was given an assignment to the Army at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, where they had the television engineering school. And after my returned from Korat, Thailand in a short period of time, I was allowed to go to Fort Monmouth and study with the Army for, well, actually it was started in September, and by the following, I think probably about March, I was completed the cross training and was assigned to George Air Force Base in California out in the Mojave Desert. And when I arrived there, I was assigned to a training unit as a television technician. And I worked in that capacity for all that would have been till 1972. And then I was given an assignment to Alaska as a television engineer. So I went and left the family there in Kansas again, and I went to Alaska.
So the family couldn't go with you, though?
Not those remote assignments like that.
Even though it was USA?
Well, you see, where I went was to a mountaintop, to Cottonwood Mountain. And McGrath was where I flew into, and McGrath, Alaska, is on the Kuskokwim River. And in there are no roads except just around town. The main street of McGrath, Alaska, is a runway for airplanes. They fly in, they fly out. And this is where I got. And then a bush pilot flew me to the airstrip that's right below the mountain and where the site was. And then I got there and I ran a television station for a year, supplying entertainment to the local residents of Sparvon, Tatalina, and the Inuits, the Eskimos in between. And I spent a year there, but I did get to come home. I went there in November, and then I come home the following June for a month, and then returned and completed my hitch there. And it was quite entertaining. They're close to Ophir, and it had recalled the excitement of the gold rush in Alaska. And I honestly got to go out and spend a day with a dredger and extracting gold from the ground in Alaska.
Exciting.
And I still have those gold nuggets, and I could show them to you if you was interested in looking at them. Raw gold right out of the Alaskan ground, right out of the river bottom.
Awesome.
Done with my own little pan, you see. Rocking and rolling.
Most people don't do that on any given day.
Oh, yeah. I got another combination metal, too, for my tour there, because the whole time I was there, not once was the station ever down. It had never happened before my arrival, and it never happened after I left.
Well, congratulations.
Dedication. Yeah.
That is awesome.
Yeah. In fact, they were so enthralled with my performance that they flew me back to Anchorage so I could watch on the wide screen at no cost to me the rumble in the jungle between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman.
That was your treat, huh?
That was my treat.
Good for you.
Come on back and watch this show free of charge. No problem, I said. All right. Cool way to go, you know, but I got this record at home that they gave me. It's put together a special recognition for,
terrific.
Once again, this remarkable performance. You know.
Yeah, terrific. What a guy.
But then, on with this, I was such a stellar performer, see, that I was from Alaska now. I was plucked up and sent to the premier assignment, the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
Ah, what was that like?
Oh, that was a reward.
Oh, I bet.
For a career, hard fought. But I went there for my terminal assignment. They took me.
Terminal assignment?
Well, see, that's your 22 years, okay?
That's now where you end your career?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it was at that time. I could have continued on, but, I opted then. I thought, well, I stayed 22 years because my daughter at the time, I didn't want to pull her out of school,
sure.
See. But I didn't have to reassign. And that was my Air Force Academy was where I finished. I retired from the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And that was in Well, October the 1st, 1978.
How long were you in Colorado Springs?
Well, I got there about 4.5 years. I got there in 74, and then, I got there in the summer of 74. And then, yeah, I'd say about 4 years I was there at the academy before retiring and going to Minnesota, Moorhead.
What were those last 4 years in Colorado Springs like?
Well, when I was there, I was involved in training the cadets. I was classified as what you call the superintendent of the teleproduction facility, where we generated video that a lot of what we do here, but see, that would be the other area over there. And I had 20 military and civilian employees that I supervised in this operation. Yeah, I got to meet some pretty neat people. I got to shake Ted Kennedy's hand when he came for a little work. You know, that was when he was much younger. And met Mr. Wizard, you know, the guy that, what was his name now? He did the science thing, you know, the TV.
Oh, okay.
Remember Mr. Wizard show? Yeah, he used to do this, you know. That's kind of some of them that would come through when we would videotape the production and the program and then distribute it for the students and training, you know, that's. And then, you know, I got a chance to do some mountain climbing and some exploration and this sort of thing, kind of delightful weekends and whatever.
Sounds like a beautiful place, beautiful way to end a military career.
Yeah, I thought so. It was nice. That's true. You know, a little reward for long, hard service.
Definitely. Now, after you had your 22 years in Colorado Springs, where was the next destination for the Nygaard family?
Right here.
Right here in fact.
Well, I tell you what, my family was here. And as I was getting prepared to retire, I had traveled up here to visit, and I had a position secured in Colorado Springs. But my family said, why don't you come back? You know? And in fact, my brother offered to provide lodgings and whatever, and I said, well, you know, I got a job. He said, well, you can get a job here. And I said, well, what? He said, look in the paper. They're looking for a television engineering out to Channel 11. He said, check that. So I went out there, and I said, you're looking for an engineer? And he said, yeah, well, I had the training, and I got my first-class FCC license. So they said, come on board. So then I had a job there at Channel 11, which was KTHI-TV. Mm-hmm. Now it's KVLY, but yeah, they took me on there, and so...
How long were you there?
I was there about a year. It was the easiest job I ever had, but it was boring because, to begin with, my license hung on the wall, and they needed that to operate the station. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was kind of like sitting around eating donuts, drinking coffee, and getting fat. I built a lot of sets for the backdrop and worked with a lot of the, you know, the news staff and whatever, and sets and whatever. But when you're watching TV, somebody's working, seeing, and I was working, and I thought, you know, yeah, I'm retired from the military. I need something that's more. So I went over and got a employment with what would have been Northern School of Supply at the time as an audiovisual technician, and then this position opened up here at the university. See, that would be in 1980. So then 21 years ago, I came over here and been here ever since, you know. So,
do you have any final thoughts about what you went through during your service to your country?
No, I served honorably and well, and I had to, like, I was good at my job. In fact, I was offered two times. I was offered once. I was offered to to go with the Blue Angels, which was the Air Force performance, the acrobatic team. Mm-hmm. And another time I was encouraged to come and work on an Air Force One, you know, the presidential airplane. But that was tempting. But see, I had a family, and it entailed a lot of travel. And with all the travel I'd done, I felt it wouldn't be fair to take that on, because it would entail, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of travel. And so but I had the clearance for it, and I had what they call the credentials. So.
And what an honor to be considered,
yeah.
to be asked. What an honor.
If you turn it down, you know, it's one thing. But I could have gone. Lyndon Johnson, you know, of course, after serving.
Yeah,
well, but it was nice. Yeah, it's nice to be asked, you know.
Yeah. Jerry, how would you like to be remembered?
Oh, you mean if I had a choice? I guess just he did what he had to. You know? See, I came from the White Earth Reservation, so mm-hmm. sunset between us and home. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anything to begin with. In fact, I think I came in owing. And from that point, I've come a long ways.
Yeah.
And I've been motivated. I've got a pretty poignant life story. See, this is just one segment of it. But in retrospect, you know, my father has a recorded oral history file here too.
Really?
Yeah. He was a pretty notorious character too.
Terrific.
But you know that it's probably what you can say is I was there, I lived my life, I did what I could to the best of my ability.
Any final thoughts before we wind up?
Well, have I kind of fulfilled what you
absolutely
needed?
Okay. Absolutely. I'm just honored that you shared your story with us.
Yeah, I hope I was able to tell it well.
Sounded good.
Oh.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
You're welcome,
thank
certainly.
You.